Okay, so first of all, let me tell you that I'm really glad to be here. And my talk will be basically about first principle data of numeric simulations. But I will start with some accurate statements, because according to the title of the talk, I'm going to discuss disordered scenarios. And first of all, I need to make a strong point that the scenario of an ideal crystal should be excluded in the case of helium-4. So first of all, I will make a statement. Of course, it will be based on some mathematical theorem, and ultimately, just I will show you definitive results of numeric simulation of helium-4, that we have at least one solid, we know at least one solid, which is not a supersolid in its ground state. It's helium-4 in the HCP crystalline phase. So the plan will be as follows. I start with a theorem which basically says that no supersolidity is possible without either vacancies or interstitials or both. And then from this theorem I will be immediately derive a corollary that continuous space supersolids are generically incommensurate. And speaking practically, this means that actually all, just speaking macroscopically, all supersolids are nothing else than modulated condensates. So all supersolids are similar to each other in macroscopic terms. Then I will show you some definitive data for HCP helium-4 crystal. I know that Massimo Bonissagni in his talk have already shown you something. I will show you one more plot just to ultimately convince you that HCP helium-4 crystal is a clear-cut insulator. So all the numerics which I will be discussing is done by Wurm Monte Carlo algorithm. I will not be discussing it because Massimo has introduced you to it. So I will be just presenting the results. So this line stands for lattice models, because first we studied some simplified lattice models just to make a point that superfluid defects in solids can be superfluid. So we saw it on lattice models, but I will not spend much time on lattice models, because I understand that, of course, you want to hear about helium. Then I will show you some new phase, metastable phase of helium-4, which we call superglass. So this is a disordered supersolid. And more interestingly, looks like the crossover from a liquid phase to a metastable superglass goes through a special phase which I call superfluid molasses. Later on, I will give you an idea of what's the difference between molasses and superglass. Then I will show you some preliminary results of our ongoing simulation of grain boundaries and ridges in helium-4 in some geometry. And finally, I will show you some experimental setup which we are going to realize at UMass. When I say we, I basically mean Bob Halleck and his student, so, and our theoretical support. Okay, so actually, just the only non-trivial case of a potential non-trivial case of a supersolid different, possibly different from Andreev Lipschitz scenario of Andreev Lipschitz and other scenario in terms of either vacancies or interstitials, is just the case of commensurate crystal. Commensurate, let me just remind you, means that the number of atoms and the number of lattice sites is one and the same, or just integer. Or for all practical purposes, it's one and the same, because we just can define a lattice in such a way that the these numbers are coincide. So these numbers coincide. So just first of all, I need to define the notion of vacancies and interstitials in the case when the numbers of atoms and lattices are equal, because when they are not equal, we can define them as just a difference. So if the number of lattices is larger than the number of atoms, we say that the difference between the number of lattices and vacancies is just the number of and atoms is just the number of vacancies, and vice versa. If the number of atoms is larger than the number of lattices, we will say that the difference is the number of interstitials. So when the number are equal to each other, you can say that naively we can say that there are no interstitials and vacancies by definition. But this is not the case. So we can apply some renormalization procedure, and I'm going to apply it to these two cartoons to see the difference. So if you look at these two pictures, you see basically one and the same. So these yellow circles stand for the hypothetical lattices, which are just geometric points in space, and these black dots represent atoms, as if we just photograph everything, as if we measure all the coordinates of all the atoms. And now we want to do the following. We want to renormalize this picture by erasing the pairs, starting from the pairs of closest distance, and then we will be renormalizing one by one all the pairs.
By pairs, you mean pairing each atom with a lattice?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Basically, the idea is presented the same as the idea of Kostrel-Stawlitz theory, when we start with some macroscopic pairs and we just renormalize them, and just end up with something. Of course, you can.
Like the negative sides of the atoms, like positive.
Absolutely, like plus and minus. So just call one plus, another minus, and start to renormalize. So I have a cartoon for you. So that's what we are doing. We are erase pair by pair and just okay.
So let me. So obviously, it's a unique way of doing that. Or?
I can define it in a unique way. I will say I will be erase each time. I will be erasing the closest pair. So find the minimal distance array. Erase. Find the minimum distance erase, and so on and so forth.
It might be fairly computationally intensive, but in principle you probably do.
Excuse me?
It might take a lot of computation time to find those pairs.
Oh, but we don't care. At this moment, we are theorists. So just okay.
So you're starting with the snapshot of the density.
Right.
Somehow you're using that to define a vacancy in an interstitial.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because.
It's just the definition. What I'm showing you is the definition. I defined some procedure. I just follow this procedure, but then we will see that it leads us basically to the same as in the case of Kostrel-Stawlitz transition.
Because it's the left and the right there, by the way.
Excuse me?
You have two different pictures. Those are just considered snapshots?
You will see the difference, because at this point we start seeing the difference, right? Because now we can clearly see that here we have pairs, and here we have something else. So let me just do the following. These are the pairs, right?
Let me ask you, what was the difference between the...
You will see it.
The after beginning.
Now you see the difference. In the very beginning, you saw nothing because you had a lot of pairs.
The two pictures were not actually identical.
Absolutely. That was my point. They looked identical, but they were not.
But another definition, the one on the right could have been, you have to show that the one on the right, you couldn't have made another way of erasing pairs that...
But he defined a unique algorithm.
I defined a unique algorithm.
So if I come up with another algorithm that allows me to erase all to end up with pairs on the right.
I don't think so, because your question applies to Kostrel-Stawlitz. So just it's basically the same. I do not say anything new compared to Kostrel-Stawlitz. It's just one-to-one procedure which we use when we discuss Kostrel-Stawlitz transition and the issue of just free and paired vortices. It's one-to-one correspondence. So. All your questions, address them please to Kostrel and Stawlitz in terms of vortices, okay? Or to me just after this talk.
Okay.
Because the next step will be absolutely straightforward. We will erase all these guys, because it's just one step more, and we end up with just empty system, like in coastal south, we do not have just free vortices. Now we do not have free vacancies or interstitials. And now we have a kind of plasma, so we have some disordered system. And we understand that if we will continue renormalizing this picture, we will, will always have this plasma with a larger and larger distance. Basically the same picture as N. Kosterlitz Thouless transition. So that's the definition, and these are two different absolutely different pictures, because we understand that if we erase at some point these guys, then the probability to have a large pair of the size of the system is macroscopically small. It's not just small, it's macroscopically small. It will be some macroscopic factor, exponential.
Is this property, the difference between the left and the right, is that a specific asymptotic behavior of the density-density correlation function?
Yes. Absolutely.
S of k goes as k squared.
Should be. I cannot quantify it right away, but absolutely, because basically in this case, each atom sits close to some sites. It cannot go far away. It's like Mott insulator.
Yeah.
No, roughly speaking, it's just like Mott insulator.
Same definition as overworld.
The same definition as
overworld.
Excuse me, equivalent to what? Well, in a sense, if you would interpret these guys as vortex, anti-vortex pair, and then in this case there will be no order, and in this case there will be order if we just interpret them as vortices. Yes, in this sense, yes.
This last step, we erased pairs. To define the pairs, you have to say that things within a certain distance were pairs and things outside that distance were not.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I could have taken this picture, and I could have taken the upper black dot and paired it with the upper yellow dot. So that's a pair and erased it too. But you didn't do that, presumably because that's outside some distance.
No. Later on, I will erase these guys. But you have to understand that if we go to some asymptotic, here we will end up with pairs. So suppose I have a pair like a fluctuation, and some distance r. But another pair of the same distance will be far, far away. And the larger r is, the larger this distance. So this ratio, r to the distance to the next pair of the same radius, r, will go to infinity. Just absolutely in one-to-one analogy with Kosterlitz Thouless. There's no difference. It's just one-to-one analogy in terms of the definition.
Now there is one crucial difference, though, which is that in Kosterlitz Thouless, the vortices have a long range of action, and vacancies and interstitials do not.
I do not discuss the physics. I do not discuss the partition function, which describes it. It's just what I see. I'm not discussing the theory why I see that. I see just I'm just describing what I see by this or that renormalization procedure. I'm not going to construct a microscopic theory. What's the difference? I'm just giving a definition, which I will be using on the next transparency.
Okay, I guess what I would say is physically, I would expect things to always be in the plasma phase.
No, helium-4 corresponds just to this. In a crystal, it corresponds to this picture.
Then there must be a long-range interaction between vacancies and interstitials, which I find kind of surprising.
It's not surprising, because quantum particles, if we translate them into the classical language, they are polymers.
But at finite temperature, what?
So what?
That's true. He has to take the limit as T goes.
Zero. Okay. So this is a strictly zero temperature phase transition between the Z phases.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Yeah.
So with this, you're creating a histogram. If you start from the distances from sites to particles,
right?
You start. You count the number of particles you remove at every distance. If you have a perfect crystal, you will have a delta at zero.
I do not understand why I just my original picture here was a perfect crystal, but our particles are quantum. They do not sit on some just at some point in space. When we just project them.
When you have this VI plasma, the tail of this distribution goes to larger distances.
In this case?
Yes. Because you have two particles that are at larger distances.
All right.
I mean,
In this case, just we will always be in plasma. So once we reach this state of plasma, itself similar, we will be reproducing it at larger and larger scales. So basically, if we erase all the pairs are of the distance 1 millimeter or centimeter, it will be just the typical correlation radius in our system.
That will be the scaling property of this distribution, this histogram.
Right. It should feature some scaling property, so it will be reproducing itself, so it will be scale invariant.
Excuse me. It seems to me that you start with a classical configuration.
It's not the classical configuration. When I measure all the coordinates, I produce just the state when same measurement.
Yeah.
I have one.
If the quantum fluctuation, zero quant fluctuation,
yes,
significant, and
it's all about 0 point fluctuations, because the point why I was drawing these atoms at some different positions, it's all comes from the probability, the distribution for all particles comes from the ground state wave function.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just discussing the picture after measurement. Suppose I take ground state wave function,
right,
and just measure all the coordinates. That's what you saw.
Yeah. So my point is the difference by the end of your procedure, if you start with two different configurations of the zero point fluctuations, how can you sure?
I see your point. Because we believe in self-averaging. Self-averaging means that if our system is macroscopic, its single configuration is representative. Because even a piece of this configuration is representative.
Okay.
That's how we treat macroscopic systems.
This is the assumption, yeah.
See? It's representative. Even a small piece of this picture just is representative. It contains all the information about it. It's basically the statement that our system is macroscopic. Okay, can I move on? I'm afraid that I will need 4 hours. Okay, so this the theorem, it's pretty simple. Once we have defined our vacancies, and you give me just some wave function which has no vacancies or interstitials, just you propose some fancy wave function to describe Moses' experiment, and in few steps I will show you that this wave function is normal.
So when you say without V's and I's, you mean without them in the sense you just applied?
Absolutely, in the sense of my definition, corresponding to this left panel, to this left empty panel. So you produce, you just write a paper saying, I figured out what's the wave function stand behind Moses Chan's experiment.
And then you do your analysis on that wave function.
You just see it. So the analysis is absolutely, I would say, even trivial. So, yeah?
Do you focus for any dimension?
Yes, absolutely. No. This has nothing to do with dimensionality, because the guys are after measurement, they are always points. So just they're all.
You're not saying that the transition between these two is costless.
No. It's the idea. It's the idea. I just need to define, because the main question is how to tell just to bounded vacancies and interstitials from free. So it's basically the definition of free and bound in the spirit of Kostler's Taulis. So just
the theorem about a state with no free.
Absolutely. And the proof is absolutely straightforward. Once there are no vacancies or interstitials, I just defined psi wiggle, which is this original psi for all physical configuration, and just zero for configurations with vacancies and interstitials, because we understand that the probability to find such a configuration is exponentially small with just macroscopic exponent, right? Just by construction. So this procedure is absolutely innocent. I am just telling that let our function be zero at configurations which do not correspond to any physics, which just are irrelevant.
That's only okay if there aren't an exponential number of configurations, vacancies and interstitials, right?
if any of them could be exponentially smaller,
then I will see them. Because look, if I see them, they are relevant. So it's one and the same. Otherwise, this procedure is not innocent. Because I have already taken into account all just probability densities and stuff by saying that I do not see them in a typical configuration. See?
You have to have both these and I.
Right, because we are discussing a commensurate state. Incommensurate is trivial.
Yeah.
We are discussing only the commensurate state, because any incommensurate state is trivial. You have carriers, either vacancies or interstitial. So incommensurate state is absolutely straightforward. The only non-trivial case, or a case which might seem non-trivial, is the case of commensurate crystal, when we are supposed to have both. So that's my innocent procedure which I do with this wave function, and the next step is actually due to Leggett. It's not just our invention. Leggett demonstrated that such a function, so you take this function and you add this exponential, so this function corresponds to a normal rotation, provided this function makes sense, because the possible problem with this wave function is that it's not single valued. See here, 1 over n, where n is the total number of particles. So in principle, this function would make no sense because it's not single-valued. But because of this property, this single-validedness is not relevant, because whenever we will try to check that it's not single-valued, so these theta's are just angles, so this is the annulus of my system. So if I would try to make sure that my function is not single valued, I would have to fix some coordinates and to move all the other coordinates or some of the other coordinates along this annulus. But when doing so, I will inevitably hit this zero, because I would produce some vacancies and some interstitials. That's absolutely clear. If I fix some number of particles and I rotate other particles, I will inevitably produce.
What about a multi-particle movement?
That's what I'm saying. I have to fix some and move.
Why do you have to fix some?
Yeah.
Why?
Because if I move all the particles, look, if I move all the particles, there's no problem, because I have 1 over n here. So to see that this guy leads to non-single validness.
What about where you move a certain ones in a circle and other ones?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I move ones, and without loss of generality do not move another one, because it's a topological property. So I either for some coordinates I have to do this 2π rotation, and for another coordinates I do not have. So, but it's all in terms of multiples of 2π.
Okay.
So, which is topologically is equivalent to saying that some are fixed in the topological sense, so I do not move them 2π, and another are rotated, and there is no way around. But once I do so, I inevitably produce vacancies and interstitials, and I hit one of these zeros, which means that this guy is single valued.
I don't see how this connects to your definition of the erasing them. Okay,
probably just, but that's also
somehow it must connect to the way you erase them, this statement.
Okay, so
I'm not quite following your argument for a different reason. If I take some subset of the atoms and move them in a circle by 2π, sure, on the way in the process, I can state their vacancies.
Right.
When I get to the end,
we do not care about the end. My point is that on your way, somewhere, you will produce a configuration with vacancies and interstitials. Not at the end. At the end, you will just have the same, the original configuration. But in the middle, because you fix some coordinates and turn other coordinates, right? So you're doing something weird, because there was a one-to-one correspondence between coordinates and sides. So the side, the coordinates which you do not move still correspond to some sides. But the guys which are moved, they produce empty sides, because you just remove them from this. Okay? So suppose we have just people sitting in the chairs. Some guy stands up and goes away. The chair will be empty. We can just rearrange all the chairs in this room. But one will be empty. What can we do? So it's not about rearranging, because the guy is absent. And one chair is free. Yeah?
So it's not clear to me, you have two concentric 1D rings. So you have 1D ring and then a larger 1D ring. You just kind of rotate them.
If I rotate the whole thing, or without loss of generality, I can fix at least one particle. Because if I
keep the whole outer ring fixed and rotate the whole inner ring.
If I rotate the whole thing, it makes no sense, because I cannot get any
outer ring fixed. So there are two rings, kind of two 1D strings.
Topologically, it's the same. If you have two concentric rings, you rotate one, it means that these guys are fixed and these guys are being rotated.
So where at any point do I construct the vacancy?
On the boundary. On the boundary. On the boundary between the rings. On the boundary between the rings, there should be some points. Just by definition, if you take some guys, because you want, basically you want to do the following. You want to do this type of ring exchange, right?
Well, I'm just imagining having a circular angle so yeah, everyone moves to the right.
I need to think about it. So let's discuss it a bit later, okay? So, but the statement is based just on the following observation. Whenever you take some guys and start to rotate them, by the way, in your case it will be, I have an answer, in your case it will be a macroscopic rotation. You will be rotating just a macroscopic amount of particles, which is a kind of special case, because we have to discuss some finite, large but finite amount, because we are discussing a macroscopic system. So just a rotating macroscopic amount of particles is just a special case. Well, this way we can rotate even a crystal. So, just okay. So let me move. That's the theorem, and that's it's immediate corollary. Because once I have free vacancies and interstitials, which I need for superfluidity, I can describe an effective theory, a long wave theory, for the superfluidity, and just. The only constraint which I will have, the only non-trivial constraint which I will have, is the constraint which comes from the fact that I can create vacancies and interstitials only in pairs. And this constraint basically fixes the phase between two fields. So it's nothing else than the statement that there is only one order parameter, despite the fact that formally we have two free fields. So. And this constraint has nothing to do with fixing the number of particles in the system. So the number of particles, or just this difference by quasi-particles, vacancies and interstitials, so their numbers are not fixed by this theory. So they are variational parameters. And once they are variational parameters, the probability that when we minimize the energy of this effective Hamiltonian, we will have this x, which is basically the difference between the numbers of vacancies and interstitials, will be zero, or any other given number is zero. It's like picking up some number on the number axis, and the probability that we will pick up number pi or zero or one is zero. It's just some special number. And once we have some generic effective Hamiltonian with no symmetry between vacancies and interstitials, this number x will come from minimizing the energy, and it will be just different from zero. So that's how we know that a super solid should be generically incommensurate. Okay, so now I would like to present some Monte Carlo results, and this is just a demonstration that we can do a large amount of helium for particles, and this is the plot when we measure density as a function of chemical potential. And actually on the next slide I will need this value of chemical potential which corresponds to the freezing density, because just we are going to study the crystal, perfect HCP crystal of helium-4 at this chemical potential to see what are the energies of vacancies and interstitials. Because once we see finite energies for vacancy and interstitial, we immediately understand that there are no free vacancies and interstitials by definition, because the gap basically means that we have that we need finite energy, and that's the end of the story. With one reservation, that we also have to check that there are no nonlinear effects. I mean that we can add a finite concentration of vacancies, and then we have to make sure that they disappear. That that we are dealing with the ground state rather than with some metastable commensurate state. Yeah.
Tau is the time difference.
Okay, I'm going to describe everything. So just this is actually the basic plot, which is a kind of piece of cake, or in Russian, foreign drink, which follows from Worm algorithm Monte Carlo. So Worm algorithm deals with Green's function, and this is just the Green's function, the log of Green's function. So we just measure the Green's function, where tau is imaginary time, and momentum is zero. So just to measure, and from this asymptotic behavior of the log of the Green's function at zero momentum, we just immediately see by a naked eye the energies for vacancy and interstitial, because it's just the slope. Basically, what we see here, and I have to add that for all practical purposes, our temperature is zero, because just we do not even heat the inverse temperature by our tau. So, for all practical purposes, it's zero temperature, and we made sure that our answers are insensitive to the system size. So, for some reason, I don't know why, so we perfectly reproduce the vacancy energy which was observed previously. For some reason, I don't know, David, so we have to discuss it, but this energy for an interstitial differs by a factor of two.
You say the energy was observed? Is it observed?
Numerically, none. And experimentally, all right.
I haven't ever seen specific heat data.
Okay, let me put it a bit different. So this value was observed in numerics, and it doesn't contradict to the experiment.
Yes,
so
it
contradicts in your opinion.
You make that point.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, so okay. So if you have a point that it contradicts the experiment, it's a separate issue. But just my understanding that there is no contradiction. So or if we interpret. Okay. So if. At least there were interpretations of the experiment in terms of this activation energy, and the plots were more or less consistent. But anyway.
Could I just ask what, because in this calculation, so you have some standard model for the potential between helium atoms?
Absolutely. It's this potential, and for example, we were able to reproduce critical temperature of liquid helium with accuracy of parts of percent. So just we can trust this potential.
And you're just doing this in a major chemical potential where it's crystalline.
Excuse me?
You're doing the your simulation in a major chemical potential where the ground state is crystalline.
Right. So it's formally it's the grand canonical ensemble, but I don't know, de facto it's canonical, because we cannot introduce even a single vacancy or a single interstitial. Okay.
Do you see that it stays in an HCP lattice the whole time?
Right. So
what is P? What is the symbol P?
This P?
Yeah.
Momentum.
Okay.
It's momentum. So basically, of course, we work in the configuration space, but then we integrate, and that's how we get zero momentum. The algorithm works in configuration space. And that's important. So just to make sure that this is the genuine ground state, we take chemical potential, we shift it in such a way that we start having some vacancies just because we change chemical potential and we are still in a crystal. So we get some vacancies. In this case, the number is about 5, and we have some 800 atoms. But then we just go back to the chemical potential corresponding to the melting curve, and we see that all vacancies disappear. So that's how we know that we are dealing with the ground state. So my point is that this is the end of the story with just perfect helium crystal. We are dealing with a clear-cut insulator. Now, just I'm going to discuss the issue of a superfluidity of interstitial. So once we know that a perfect helium-4 crystal is a boring dead insulator, we want just to have some, at least to have some models which would describe superfluidity of defects. And this is the simplest model. It's a lattice model when we have a half filling on a lattice. The solid, by definition, is the state which breaks translation and invariance. And you see here an interface. So these are two domains, and this is the interface. And in this picture, it's an insulating interface. So just no fluctuations. But just if you treat this system quantum mechanically, we see that depending on parameters, we have a superfluid interface. So just we saw it explicitly on the computer, but I have no time to go into the details because the physics is pretty interesting, especially in two-dimensional case when the superfluid interface is one-dimensional, and we have just an interesting interplay between superfluidity and roughening. So basically, superfluidity comes simultaneously with roughening. We have spinons, particles, quasi-particles, which carry charge 1/2 and just a quantum of roughening, but all this stuff goes beyond my presentation. It's all published, so if it's interesting, I will be really glad to discuss all this stuff.
So the material above and below is normal crystals?
All right. It's an insulated... All right. And depending on parameters. So if you change parameters, there's a quantum phase transition. So the phase transition in the bulk is first order phase transition. So you have first order phase transition in the bulk.
Between
a superfluid and solid, because we are discussing quantum phase transition.
The superfluid and the normal solid.
And the normal solid, right. So because we just change the parameters of interaction and nothing more. Temperature is zero for all practical purposes. But and then in some range of parameters, the bulk is normal and solid, and the interface is superfluid. But then you continue, say, to increase the repulsion between particles. And at some point, you will have a second-order quantum phase transition. In this case, it's basically the standard mode transition. So you will have a standard mode transition.
In the bulk?
No, here. Because bulk is already insulating. Except for the interface in 2D, when the interface is one-dimensional, and I was already saying that then it's a peculiar transition because it involves both roughening and superfluidity. But I want to skip this issue. It's very interesting, just my personal just viewpoint. It's extremely interesting, but it's not the issue which I would like to discuss today. Okay, so let's go to helium. And just to start with, we did a very simple numeric experiment. So we just took helium at high enough temperature when it's disordered, normal, so nothing like crystal, and we just quenched it to the famous temperature 0.2K to see what happens. Just instead of thinking, we decided, why don't we just press the button and see what happens. And we saw a state which we call superglass. So a bit later I will define what do we mean by a superglass. Basically these are some characteristics. This is the single particle density matrix averaged, so that's why it's flat. Actually, it's some function of coordinate. I will show this function on the next slide. And this is the density-density correlator, or the structure factor, which demonstrates that we are dealing with something which is different from the crystal. We observed a finite rho S, which is less, it's some 7%, pretty high. And the system was pretty large. It was 800 atoms, and the density, actually by mistake, we wanted to make a simulation at the melting curve, but just plugged some wrong number in the computer, and we were lucky. Otherwise, probably we would miss this superglass. Okay, so this is a very important slide. So it shows the condensate wave function. Let me explain how to read this slide. So these are 10 slices. So we have a three-dimensional system, and just to represent, it, technically it's convenient, to represent the wave function of the condensate in each slice. So suppose I have a z-axis and I slice my system across this z-axis. I represent...
These are all slices at the same time?
No, because in this algorithm you cannot measure, you cannot just take a configuration and measure condensate density. Condensate density corresponds to some statistics of some just ends of the word lines. So actually you have to simulate long enough. Otherwise you just do not know what is the condensate density. So in this representation, and this polymer representation, condensate density corresponds to statistics of the ends of the broken line. So once you see just the broken line, you know nothing. So it's just a special way how you translate from the statistical polymers into just some physical quantity. So just.
But if you could do it in an experiment, just you say these are 10 slices along the z-axis, but there's some relationship between these slices, right?
They just go one by one.
I mean, it's like if you could measure the momentum distribution with a neutron simultaneously at all the slices,
right.
You would expect.
It's a static picture. So what is important that would we have a liquid, it will be just some gray picture without any structure, because we are supposed to have a constant condensate in a liquid. So the point is that we have broken translation symmetry, which we explicitly see.
So in crystal, each of these pictures would be an identical lattice.
Right.
Well, identical, well, except for whatever.
In a super solid. So in a crystal, if it's not super solid, we do not have condensate at all. So there is no picture like that, because if there's no. So once you have a super solid and you have condensate density, you would see a periodic structure. So instead of the stochastic distribution of black, white, and gray, you would just see, white and black points, white corresponding to lattice sites, black corresponding something like that. I don't know. Anyway, you would see broken translation symmetry, yes, but it would be a regular pattern.
What's the scale of this picture?
Oh, it's a good question. See, we have roughly speaking 1,000 atoms, which means that we have some 10 atoms per dimension. So that's the scale. You have 10, roughly speaking, 10 interatomic distances here. And from this estimate, you immediately see that the correlation radius is of order unity in terms of interatomic. There is no order. There is no even order at the distance of typical interatomic separation. Just, it's an absolutely disordered state, absolutely surprising, because...
And I think you just answered my other question, which is how far apart vertically is each slice? I guess each one is one interatomic spacing above the previous one.
All right, so that was the reason to take 10 slices, just to have just to make sure that there is no correlation, big correlation between this one and this one. But we already see it when we go this x, y, and x and y direction, but the same we see when we go z. So this is the z direction. So basically we see that correlations die away at the distance of order unity.
Did you check that the correlations are actually isotropic?
Isotropic? What do you mean isotropic?
Because they fall off the same way in the x direction as in the y direction.
Oh, we didn't check that, but I would say that more or less everything is seen by a naked eye. You just see no structure. I don't know. I fail to see any structure.
But, the other reason I ask that question is that sometimes things like orientation order can be quite subtle to the naked eye, but then what's...
Oh, maybe, but...
Also through translation. Maybe... Identical pictures side by side, one's a way
yes,
fancy wave, and you're asked to tell them apart by eye, and
probably, yes, but okay. Somehow I do not see whether it's relevant or not. So the point is...
If very relevant, if this is translationally ordered, then it's not a glass. It doesn't look translationally ordered, but I'm saying
I see.
Nice
so,
to check. So you, you, absolutely sure
it's
not
so. So your point is that it's some metastable thing which at short distances is disordered, but
there could be a very weak density wave in this, and your naked eye would not see.
Okay, but I would say that in this case, in the period of this wave, should be much larger than interatomic separation, and probably it will be comparable to the system size.
Not the usual wave.
Okay.
But still, I don't see why you don't say that's not a liquid.
It's not a liquid?
Yeah, why?
Oh, that's a good question, because we performed, so do you see this estimate? So what we did, we performed 10 to the fourth power sweeps, which means that we tried to shake each portion of our polymer just 10 to the fourth power time.
These sweeps are all single particle.
Right. So we tried to change single particle configurations 10 to the fourth power times. And there is some correspondence. Of course, we cannot just directly project this to the real-time dynamics, but we know that once there is, it's a kind of jamming, right? So we definitely see a jamming, because just somehow we cannot update our system. And so we see this jamming, and we understand that the only reason for this jamming in terms of Ohm algorithm, which is otherwise very efficient, is just the jamming in the diagonal channel. That just polymers do not want to change their position with respect to each other. And then we understand that we have some potential barriers, and we also understand that the exponential expression, which is responsible for suppressing quantum tunneling, we typically, when we do analytics, we calculated it using imaginary time. So that's the point. So in real-time dynamics, there are two factors. A prefactor, which comes from dynamics, which cannot be captured by Monte Carlo, and another is an exponential factor in imaginary time, which describes a deep under-barrier motion. And we hope that somehow Monte Carlo is sensitive to this exponential factor describing deep under-barrier motion. And so we are saying that we tried this under-barrier motion with each element of our configuration 10 to the fourth power time. And we understand that a single trial corresponds to the inverse Debye frequency. So the typical time in this problem is inverse Debye frequency. So that if we have tried each piece 10 to the fourth power times, probably we can estimate that at least the time of relaxation is larger than this expression. So just typical time, typical microscopic time, times the number of attempts which we need to have just to tunnel, speaking classically, to get through the barrier. And that's the estimate of the time. We do not know what happens then when we will be simulating longer.
I mean, this is like the situation between Moses and John Ruffy that we do it, and very often we find it crystallizes.
When you do
it in much less time,
And probably you are doing much less system.
In a different way, I'm sure. Yeah.
And probably, but how large is your system?
Well, the system, I don't know, it is maybe half the size, right?
And how large is your density? This one? Because
even a smaller density.
Not even, because if you take a smaller density, the picture becomes even more intriguing. So
you would think that the higher the density, the more it would favor a crystal.
The more it would favor a glass. My point is that if I just increase density, this glassiness will persist forever. So the larger the density, the more jammed is the state. That's
the
my
more point. It gains by some sort of multi-particle tunneling into the
I think it doesn't gain at all, because it's basically a jamming. Because equivalent classical system is a system of polymers. So you just take polymers, your temperature is finite, because equivalent temperature is given by quantum mechanical Hamiltonian, it's finite. And then you increase the density, you just jam poor thing. So classical analog is just finite temperature, some polymer, and you are jamming it. So intuitively, it's clear that it gets stuck
you sometimes find a crystal forming?
No, never. But actually, we have basically we did only two runs, roughly speaking.
Oh, I see. I mean, we've done thousands of runs, I guess, and if we go long enough, we always find a crystal. But different conditions, I'm sure.
Yeah, we can compare our conditions. But look.
Do you remember the dilatation times probably?
Probably shorter. But, I mean, usually in computer time,
Probably, yes. So what are we doing at the moment? At the moment, we are trying another another geometry when we prepare a seed by hand. We surround it with a glass, because if it's the matter of just producing a seed, a matter of nucleation, this guy will just explode, because we already prepare a seed.
So you start from a liquid, Mark, in this case.
In this case, we start from a liquid and just quench it.
Is the density, so there's some density of the snapshot of the liquid that you start with, right?
That's
some snapshot of a liquid that you quench it.
Right. Snapshot. Well, liquid, because you know that we simulate polymers.
Yeah, no.
So we start with some configuration of polymers.
Is the change, does the actual location of these polymers change significantly once you quench it? Because all that happens is you're seeing essentially a snapshot of the liquid here.
We didn't check what happens to this thing when we just quench it, because in my opinion it's not that relevant, because we just measure what we end up with, and we know that the state is metastable anyways, because we know that the crystal is a dead insulator and it's not a crystal and it's a superfluid. So just our purpose was to produce some metastable state, and we explicitly see that it's metastable.
So I guess what I'm saying, though, is if you have this simulation, right, and you're simulating these polymers, at any point you freeze it down,
all right,
you may end up just taking whatever current snapshot you're in and just kind of being stuck there.
All right. I guess that's exactly what happens. So we just quench it, and some configuration, the whole thing gets stuck. And then we still have some non-trivial update, because just David will tell you that it's impossible to have finite superfluid density without statistics of winding numbers. So we still have statistics of winding numbers. So there is still some life in the system. It's not just like getting stuck. If you get stuck, you have some finite winding number, and you just do not know your superfluid density. We have a reasonable statistics for superfluid density, which means that we update our winding number. So a part of the system is not stuck. The part of the system leaves, just reconnects, produces winding numbers, and stops. Excuse me?
You have local moves that change your winding
numbers. We have one algorithm. It does everything. It does everything. Basically, we have two ends, which correspond to the Green's function, and these ends is basically the meaning of the word worm. So they go like that. They produce just everything. So basically, the whole thing looks like a sponge soaked with superfluid. Sponge is solid. Superfluid is superfluid. So it's a kind of two-component system for all practical purposes. So it's part. So
it's like it assembles its own bicorp.
All right. So yeah. So just it's Vicor, which is made out of helium.
It's. But of course, I'm sorry. The point is, are you speculating that this is what Moses has in his apparatus?
No. Maybe. But our idea was very simple. Why don't we just? We wanted to produce polycrystallite structure. We didn't want just to produce. We didn't expect to see that. Our idea was very simple. Why don't we just quench the system and see some polycrystallite structure? Probably that structure would be directly relevant just to the experiment. And instead of this structure, we saw this picture. Probably this picture is relevant to another experiment, to an unknown experiment, which I am going to discuss a bit later. But let me tell one more thing, which for me is absolutely striking and surprising. So when we go to smaller density, we do not see this picture. We see a homogeneous condensate. So everything is homogeneous, but define the solid. Probably just we do not need it, but anyway, I have already told you that for all practical purposes, the superglass works like a sponge soaked with the superfluid and so on. But if you want just to define everything mathematically, we would say that a solid is a state with broken translational symmetry. A quasi-solid is a state which is indistinguishable from a solid during some time, because actually I cannot tell you what will happen during larger times, but if this time is much larger than the inverse Debye frequency for all practical purposes, that small times we will see a solid. Finally, a glass is a disordered solid, and a superglass is a glass that supports a superflow. Okay. So now let me describe just another simulation when we have density close to the melting curve, pretty close to the melting curve, the same temperature 0.2 K, the same number of atoms, and we see something absolutely weird, because if we discuss the condensate wave function, it's homogeneous. The picture, I do not show you the picture because you will not tell the picture which comes from Monte Carlo and the picture which I would produce with random number generator. Absolutely identical. Absolutely. The same arrangement. We do absolutely the same. We see no crystal. This density corresponds to the melting curve of a crystal. So it's a solid density. It's not a density of a liquid. It's a density of a solid. But in terms of condensate wave function, the whole thing behaves like a liquid. But the behavior is absolutely weird, because the convergence of the Wohm algorithm is absolutely poor, while the rho s is on the order unity. It can be 0.6, it can be 0.9. Moreover, it can be larger at larger temperature, and the error bar is huge. It's actually on the order of 100%. So it's an absolutely weird state.
So why isn't this just a statement that the Wohm algorithm is not well suited to learn?
Wohm algorithm works perfect for a superfluid, and it works perfect for it's perfect for a crystal.
Maybe you just know because our algorithm doesn't have this property.
Does not have that property. Okay, just to do 800 particles with your algorithm at this density, and we will just see what happens.
No, the initial conditions are different also.
Oh.
You just start from the same initial condition.
No. Oh, there are differences. There are a lot of differences. But we should continue. We can.
Sure. We will discuss.
It's already going in an hour. So.
Okay, yeah. So, well.
If the error is 100%, does that mean that your result is actually consistent with rho s equals 0?
No, because just 100% is not 1,000%. We see winding numbers from time to time. When it's an insulator, when it's zero, you just do not see winding numbers at all. Or you get stuck at some winding number and you cannot update it. We are updating our winding numbers and they do not converge to zero. If it's an insulator, they will converge to zero. Or you will always see something like 17, for example. Your number will be always 17 and you will understand. Because basically superfluid response comes from the statistics of the winding number, not just from a single winding number, but from statistics of them. So we still see statistics, but it's poor. The convergence is poor. It's not easy to update. By the way, David, how do you update statistics of your winding numbers when you have a large number of particles?
We make permutations of like 10 out.
And you are saying that you will have a good statistics of this thing.
Well, it's extremely slow.
Okay. I would love.
Like 10 times okay. My computer time with okay. Good results.
We need to talk and talk up. Yeah. I doubt that you will be able just to update these things. But just the idea which the point which I am going to make is that at this point we have a very strange system which at short times, but still larger than the inverse Debye frequency behaves basically like a glass. But at larger time, you see just some quantum, slow quantum motion. So it's a jammed system. There is some quantum jamming. But you see that the system behaves like a liquid. Everything becomes homogeneous only at large enough times. And I believe that this is a crucially important, because we have just two different things. So with respect to an external particle, this state can be absolutely viscous, because in the diagonal channel, the relaxation times are huge. So if the system wants somehow to change the density profile, it requires a huge time. It's like molasses. But still, the system conducts superflow of its particles. It's a kind of controversial, counterintuitive, I would say, system. That's how I can interpret what we see. And this is.
Would it be fair to think of this as a system that's close to its last transition, but still on the liquid side?
All right. That's exactly what you see on this slide. Okay. So you can continue. That's exactly what I'm showing here. So this is a hypothetical line. I don't even know because we have not do all the simulation. We just studied some points like here and here, just 2 points. Whether this line is stable enough, but it's a hypothetical phase diagram. So this is the known line, liquid vapor line. This is the line of superfluid to normal phase transition. Here we have a superglass, and then if pressure is high enough, it will just go normal glass or Bose glass. It's just a good term for this normal glass phase. And what I mean by molasses is, yes, it's something like just like almost a glass, but from the superfluid set. But actually, there is no good theory. We do not actually know whether it's a phase transition or just a kind of crossover. So it may happen that actually a superglass is always like a molasses at large enough time. So just, I do not even know. So it's, in my opinion, it's a theoretical challenge to understand just this glassy or molasses behavior. Okay, and let me just tell you about this very interesting and pretty recent experiment. When people of Balibar's group were looking for bulk nucleation. So they wanted to produce a solid nucleus by compressing liquid helium with some acoustic technique because they wanted to avoid nucleation on walls. And there was some simple theory which predicted that at the pressure of some 65 bars, the system will become absolutely unstable. So it should immediately produce a seed. So they have reached 160 bars and saw nothing. It's absolutely amazing. And one of the possible explanations was that the system becomes glassy, but not in just in the sense of super glass, but that it becomes normal. So now we understand that actually it can remain superfluid, and just it can behave like this molasses or even super glass. So in my opinion, what we saw just on the previous slides is directly relevant to the outcome of this interesting experiment. But still, just we need to think about that more. So probably all this is more relevant to this experiment rather than to Moses' experiment directly. But still, I think that there should be something important just about this glass. So let me just discuss the boundaries, the great boundaries now, because just the original idea how to interpret Moses' experiment was that we have grains which are insulators, and we have grain boundaries which are two-dimensional superfluids. We have a network of them. That's what we saw in our lattice models. So why don't we have it with helium? And after seeing the superglass, we were almost 100% sure that any grain boundary will be superfluid. So just we decided to study the simplest ones when we just take an HCP crystal. These are two planes, and the whole thing is just periodic periodic continuation of these two planes, which form HCP crystal. We just wanted to produce in each plane a low angular grain boundary and to see what happens. So just we simulated these guys, and to our surprise, these guys were insulating, just clear-cut insulators. So the bottom line is not all grain boundaries are superfluid in helium. So the crystal is a dead insulator, and some...
There must be error bars on that, right? I mean...
We can do...
an insulating grain boundary, or...
It's an insulating grain... I mean that we do not see winding numbers at all.
Well, there's some error bars, right?
All right. With some error bars, just no single, and of course we can do finite size analysis and see that the rho s is zero.
But it couldn't be just that the rho s is sufficiently small. That
No. You always can tell when in Monte Carlo you see, even when you're on an insulator, you see some rho s, and then you see that the finite size analysis leads you to zero. And in this case, we just didn't see Reinink numbers at all. Sorry.
But we also have the one-body density matrix.
Excuse me?
We also have the one-body density matrix.
For this guy. But it's one and the same. So if your rho s is 0, your single particle density matrix is 0 as well. Because,
but you can see that it goes down exponentially, even though the winding number you may have fluctuation.
All right. We can also just take the larger system. But David, you know that it's easy to tell a dead insulator just with some from some margin. So you see it with a naked eye when you have a dead insulator. So there's no doubt.
What you're saying here seems to suggest that you can change the conditions somehow and make a grain boundary that's not insulated.
It will be on the next slide. Because, see, this thing is very symmetric. What we do, we just take plane and we do like that and like that. Okay? It's not a generic situation. It's a very special situation. It's pretty special. Because we just do everything in planes. What we can do generically, and this will be shown on the next slide, I hope.
So, are you saying that all grain boundaries that just correspond to rotations in plane?
In your HCP crystal, there are special planes. Right. All right, two of them. If our grain boundary is done by just cutting this plane and rotating a little bit and shifted by a half of a period, see, everything is shifted by half of a period. In this special symmetric configuration, this guy will be an insulator. But it's not a generic case. Generic case is just you have two arbitrarily chosen Euler angles, and you just combine the guys and see what happens. And this, and you will see this.
You're saying all grain boundaries of this special type are insulating, independent of the angle of the grain boundary?
Yeah, because actually there are no... We checked a couple of them, and maybe three, and all were insulating.
That doesn't sound like it's enough to rule out the possibility that there's some range of angles that are super...
Yeah, you do not... let me tell you one thing. You cannot produce just angles with some difference, because you have HCP crystal, which means that this angle cannot be really large because of this symmetry.
It's between 0 and 60 or something.
because it's pretty symmetric. See what I mean? This angle can never be large enough. Because of this symmetry.
I'm thinking more, could there be some special behavior of very long angle?
We go on to the next slide.
Okay, I didn't know the answer. Yeah. But we decided, why don't we do something generic? Once we see some insulators, the next point is, why don't we do anything generic? Because otherwise you will immediately challenge me, saying, okay, but how do you know that if I see something insulating, something not insulating, how do you know what's the generic situation? You will see, what? You say at least one insulator, you say at this point, stop, we need a generic situation. So that's the generic situation. That's our geometry. We take a cube which consists of 8 cubes, and each cube contains each cube is a crystallite. So what we do, we take an infinite crystal and we cut a cube out of it with absolutely arbitrary orientation of the cube with respect to the crystal. This way we have 8 different crystallites. We just compose a system out of these 8 crystallites and see what happens. So that's the same. So this is the same map of the condensate wave function. So just to enhance the readability, I just expanded the plot. So this is the actual size of the simulation box. It's just in terms of cubes, it's 2x2, and I just added one layer everywhere just to enhance readability. And so now we have just 4 slices for simplicity. So we have 2 slices which course, and the whole thing is periodic. So this phase is the same as this one. So we have 4 slices. This one corresponds to this special plane when we have the grain boundary. This slice corresponds to the case when we do not have in our plane this grand boundary, grand boundary once again, and no grand boundaries. So that, that's why we see. So that's how our four slices go, and these are just different axes. We can slice across x-axis, across y-axis, across z-axis. So that's why these guys are more whitish, because basically. Oh, I'm afraid that I was not accurate. So basically, first of all, I a little bit translate the whole thing, so just my picture is not accurate. So when I processing the whole thing, I was a bit translating. So basically, these guys correspond to this slice and this slice, and these two guys correspond to this plane and this one. So that's why these guys are more black. So we have condensate here. For example, this is a condensate, and this looks like a superfluid a grade boundary, because you see that we have a large area, a large black area. Simultaneously, this, for example, grade boundary doesn't look like superfluid. This probably yes, because just it's a large dark area. So what can we conclude from this picture? I would say that the picture is not conclusive enough. Because we have a lot of just white spots, which means that we have grain boundaries, like this one, this one, this one, this one, which do not seem unambiguously superfluid. I would call them rather insulating. So probably we can talk of superfluid ridges instead of superfluid boundaries, because we definitely see that along the ridges we have condensate. And actually, when we measure rho s, we do see that the whole thing is superfluid. So at this moment, I would call these results preliminary, and we need to go into more details to figure out actually what we are dealing with. So what's the mechanism? Whether we are dealing with superfluid ridges or superfluid boundaries. So just at this point, let me just discuss the experimental evidence. So we already know something. We know that an ideal crystal of helium-4 is an insulator, that in principle we can have superfluid interfaces, superfluid ridges. And why don't we just discuss some evidence, some experimental evidence, which can be interpreted as the evidence in favor of the disordered scenario. Of course, these are all known things. Let me just remind you them one by one and just interpret them in terms of disordered scenario. First of all, is the absence of U1 universality class features. U1 is the same XY than XY. So no U1 behavior of the master curve for the rho S. Its behavior is different. So we can just interpret it as if the behavior is masked by non-universal behavior of disordered superfluid network. We do not know what is it. What is this network? It may be a network of ridges of superfluid grain boundaries. It may be a network of dislocations, all of that, and also a network of a mixture of a glass and polycrystallite, or just a glass. I don't know. So at this moment, I am not ready just to interpret the experiment itself. Another important issue is the role of helium-3. It's a kind of interesting, actually absolutely surprising, because there's just small concentrations are good, and we can easily interpret it as if the small concentration of helium-3 stabilizes disordered state. It's known that if you want to produce a glassy state or form single component system, it's a good idea to add something to it to stabilize disorder. The contaminating effect of larger concentration can be easily explained if you have a network, because basically you have bottlenecks, and these guys can just block the bottlenecks. We were discussing it yesterday evening, for example. Another amazing fact that was mentioned yesterday by Moses, and just shame on me, I didn't realize that it's crucially important unless Moses just draw my attention to it, is the behavior of the heat capacity. Heat capacity is linearly proportional to temperature. It's an absolutely weird behavior for a three-dimensional superfluid. But it's not at all weird for a glass. It's just typical for a glass to have linear behavior of heat capacity. And finally, I would say that for me, the most non-trivial effect which is seen in the experiment in this torsional Australia experiment is the limitingly small critical velocity. It cannot be actually smaller because it's on the order of minimal, it is on the order of a single, I don't know, three quanta of circulation. It's just, for me, it's absolutely impossible to imagine such a behavior in any regular superfluid, whether it's a supersolid or just supersolid, superfluid porous, I don't know, disordered, whatever. It's just absolutely weird thing. And the only just idea which I have at the moment, probably it's somehow relevant to the quantum molasses in the sense that probably what is seen is not just dissipative flow when you have phase slips, but it's a kind of extremely nonlinear response when you still have a super phenomenon, but your superfluid density is a strong function of velocity. In which case we could just expect something like that. But still, I do not have any just direct explanation. So finally, let me just tell you what are our own ongoing simulations and what are our planned simulations, because just we have a lot of simulations running at the moment. And first of all, we need to establish, we want to establish liquid glass phase diagram. Then we want to continue with grain boundaries and ridges to end up with something definitive. Then it's very important and interesting to study a dislocation, whether a dislocation is an insulator or a superfluid. Finally, we want, I was already telling about that, we want to insert a crystallite in a superglass and to see whether it will grow or just it will be stuck. And the same way, we want to have a superglass between crystallites to see what happens, whether this crystallite will grow on the two just setups are pretty close to each other, but there's still some difference. So basically, this can give us an idea of whether the idea of this polycrystallite and glass mixture is relevant to the Moses's experiments.
I think it's important to realize that there is no theory of linear specific heat for an ordinary glass.
But there is a fact.
Only theory. I do not believe that it's a microscopic theory. So there is no microscopic theory.
But what we can do, we can simulate heat capacity as well. Once we have a first principle scheme.
I don't think anyone ever has.
The two-level scenario
is just a scenario.
Yeah.
And they could equally well, you know, you could have got vortex motions in the superfluid. It could be a quantum phenomenon.
In ordinary glasses?
In ordinary glasses. In fact, they are. There's a quantum tunneling in ordinary glasses. Whatever it is, it's known to be quantum tunneling. But to me, it's very significant that this unsolved problem in ordinary glasses is
I think it's kind of interesting. Maybe we can do something about the glass problems with helium.
Okay.
Sure.
It's not the end of the story. I need to show you just one important.
Well, let's go back to slide number three before.
Oh, okay. Go back, because I need just to show you one more slide, and that will be the end of it.
What?
Okay. Yeah. Why don't we finish, and then we can? I will. Yeah, because it will be natural. Because actually, I want to show this, one experimental geometry, just which we call UMass sandwich, and we are going to implement it. And I'm saying we. I basically mean Bob Hallock at UMass and his student Michael Ray, and just theoretical support comes from Nikolai and me. So that's the geometry, and that's the idea. Actually, we want to realize a junction between superfluid and supersolid, in which case we can basically we will be able to study superconductivity of a supersolid. So instead of squeezing superfluid component out of supersolid, we just want to make this guy to conduct superfluid component. And the idea is that we want to pin the solid-liquid interface by some porous material. Actually, we are thinking of Vicor. Because once Vicor suppresses solidification, and we are close to the point of coexistence of supersolid and superfluid, this boundary between solid and superfluid will be pinned to this phase of Vicor. It's just a capillary effect, nothing more. And once we have this, we can actually work with some small enough pressure differences. So basically, the system is stable to pressurizing. We can slightly pressurize superfluid, say here, having this fill line, and then a differential pressure gauge will immediately tell us whether there is a flow through this supersolid or not. Whether this, or, well, if it's a supersolid, it will be a flow. So whether there is a flow or not, whether this guy is supersolid or just insulator. And in this geometry, we can just equivalently replace a pressure gauge with just a line, and we can think of creating a persistent current. So basically, it's a kind of circuit where instead of electrons, you have just superfluid helium. Now it's basically the end of the
circuit. What pressure gauge can you make?
Excuse me?
How small pressures can you measure?
Me? I cannot just say. I'm a theorist. But Bob Halleck says that there should be no problem.
Like 10 to the minus 3 bars? Or 10
don't ask me about numbers. See?
You need something of the order of 10 to the minus 6 bars.
It's probably possible.
Well, if it's possible to work with squeezing out. Anyway, in terms of pressurizing, this, in my opinion, just it's the most sensitive setup, because basically you work with fluid, you do not pressurize.
With a Josephson junction, you have to be at exactly zero voltage before you see any current, and this is a very comparable system.
Absolutely.
You have to. It may be that the pressure differential in which the supercurrent flows must be very, very small indeed.
To start with, we just want to make sure that this guy is transparent for superfluid. Okay, we do not discuss even superflow at this point. We just want to see that something goes from here to here. The difference between pressures goes to zero.
So this is then along the melting line?
We are on the melting curve. Otherwise, we will not have this interface. We are on the melting curve, pretty close to it. But then, because this interface is pinned, we can a little bit change the pressure of superfluid, and nothing will happen. It's just a standard capillary effect. When a pressure can jump just over the interface.
Ethan had a question for you.
Why wouldn't you just take Moses' blocked annulus experiment, and instead of blocking it with a piece of brass, block it with a piece of Vicor? And then you would see that, I mean, if you get flow from superfluid through the, or from the solid, from the supersolid in the bulk, through the fluid and the Vicor, I mean, if it doesn't flow, then it looks just like a blocked annulus. If it flows any, then you should get non-classical inertia.
That's a torsional oscillator.
Sure. It's a torsional oscillator. We just want another geometry because there is a contradiction. Yesterday we've heard an interesting talk by John Bimmer that when you just try to squeeze your supersolid, nothing comes out.
Sure.
It can be just easily because the signal, you can just cannot resolve the signal. Because, for example, if you are squeezing a sponge and if you are squeezing a porous rock, say wet brick, qualitatively it's one and the same. But quantitatively, how how much water can you squeeze out of a rock, of a brick. And in this geometry, there's no such a problem. You just take water and just filter it through your rock.
I think we're going to take a break here, but Bill had one question.
We can return. So basically, this I might
go back to way back to the beginning, about your third slide.
Okay.
One that had the Leggett theorem on it.
Okay, just a moment.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay.
The point I wanted to make, when you say psi wiggle is zero for configuration for the denial, that zero has to be configured or combinatorial small.
Absolutely.
Configuration with V's
right.
And
right.
Has an enormously larger normalization.
It should be small in the physical sense. But it's exactly what corresponds to my definition. So my definition was exactly in the physical sense. When I look at the system at a representative configuration, and for any microscopic system, a single configuration is representative, I look at this configuration and I see no V's and I's. That's how I conclude that all the combinatorial factors are already taken into the account, because I'm just discussing the properties of the representative configuration. I'm not discussing how I deduce these properties, because I work like an experimentalist. I just measure.
That merely proves that your algorithm is not ergodic.
Excuse me, it has nothing to do with which algorithms?
Your algorithm for finding configurations.
I do not find them. Nature finds. So my point is that I take a natural configuration. I do not just calculate it. I just take natural configuration, measure it. It's a Gedanken experiment. I take natural wave function, whatever it is. I just perform a single measurement of all part of all coordinates, and then.
How did you find that wave function?
It's not my problem, because see, you just give me this. Nature finds it. I just I just perform a measurement with this wave function.
My point.
I do not. My point is that I do not need to find this psi. My point is that my point is very simple. Once this psi ground exists,
yeah.
See, if
it. Yeah, that probably should be if.
If.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Maybe it's the problem with my English, not with this ground state wave function.
Well, I think this is actually a problem I had.
What I'm saying is that you have removed a combinatorially large normalization volume from your problem completely, and that's very unsafe.
I'm afraid I didn't get it. What is unsafe? Because I'm describing not the function, I'm describing the measurement on this one.
From then on, you work with that
kind of function. I do not work with that. That's only the thing I do with that.
All right.
Everything is on this screen, so I do not do anything which goes beyond these two slides, this one and the previous one.
I have a question here. In Lockett's paper, what's important for the not classical rotational initial momentum is that the energy level for the ground state wave function should be sensible to the twist phase boundary conditions. But in your slides here, you have. There's no mention of that.
He didn't put in all the steps, but I think maybe you should just discuss this with him. I think he just didn't put in all the steps there, right?
I'm pretty sure that I said almost everything.
Thank you.